happen, we have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Everybody, welcome to Gay USA. I'm Ann Northrup.
And I'm Maren Johns, editor-in-chief of Queer 40. It's lovely to be back here, Ann.
It's lovely to have you here, Maren. Andy is on vacation. So Maren, who sits in here sometimes as one of our substitute co-hosts, has agreed to join us today. As she said, she is the editor-in-chief of Queer 40, which you can find at queer40.com, and the former editor-in-chief of Curve magazine. So a longtime journalist in the LGBTQ plus community, and therefore we're happy to have her here. We have a lot of news today. We are going to start, hold on, let me get myself oriented, with a guest. Fear of monkeypox is spreading as fast as the virus, and so we've invited Anthony Fortenberry, the chief nursing officer at New York City's Callan Lord Community Health Center, which has been serving the LGBTQ plus community for decades, to join us here and answer questions about monkeypox, because they, of course, are dealing with this on a daily basis.
But first, we're going to whiz through a few headlines to give you a preview taste of what's to come. We have a right-wing Republican congressman who, even though he voted against the Respect for Marriage Act in the House, just attended his gay son's wedding.
It's getting to be a little more nuanced story than I expected. Not so nuanced, neo-Nazis have attacked a drag queen story hour in Boston. We'll tell you about that and a lot of other similar incidents.
And a lot of people are really confused whether or not D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser has come out, or if she's in the closet, or if there's no closet and no out. We don't know.
And if you think we have all the answers, you'd be wrong. Legendary Philadelphia leader Rita Odessa has died at age 76. She was a pistol.
And down under, a bit of bad news for my home team, rugby players. They have refused to wear pride-themed jerseys and put their match, which is on today, at risk.
See, it's only a coincidence that we have Australian Maren Johns here to discuss this, but it is a happy coincidence because she can give us the real inside emotion on this. Meanwhile, thousands defied homophobic Hungary President Viktor Orban by marching for pride in Budapest.
And there's some interesting news out of the Montreal International AIDS Conference. It seems there are two more cases where HIV is potentially being cured.
Very interesting. And a very lesbian, a League of Their Own series, playing off the movie from years ago, is coming to Amazon Prime on August 12th.
And great fallout from Comic-Con. It has been confirmed by Marvel that Michaela Cole will play a queer character in the Black Panther sequel, Wakanda Forever.
Yes, very exciting. All right, so let's introduce our guest. Anthony Fortenberry is the chief nursing officer of the Callan Lord Community Health Center, a place we all revere for its decades of work for the community. Thank you for joining us, Anthony. You're an RN and, as I said, chief nursing officer. Tell us, please, what you're seeing at Callan Lord in terms of monkeypox cases.
First of all, thank you so much for having me on to talk about monkeypox, or as we call it, MPV, or monkeypox virus. We saw our first case at Callan Lord, our first confirmed case of MPV back on June 3rd. And in the subsequent weeks, we've seen an exponential increase in patients coming in, both for testing and confirmed positive cases. Our numbers of confirmed positive cases are now in the triple digits across the country. As far as the latest data that we have from the CDC, we've got about 3,500 cases across the United States, the most in the world. And New York state accounts for about a third of those cases. And so at Callen Lord, if we're in the triple digits, you know, you can see that we are seeing a huge percentage of cases across the country, and are really inundated with demand for services far outreaching what we have capacity.
Well, that's a depressing statement right there. You know, when I have to admit that when I first heard about this, we were told, you know, it's not fatal except in rare cases. It's something you get over in a couple of weeks. You know, is this really such a big deal? But it seems to be getting scarier and scarier. First of all, you don't know about mutations and where it might be going. But tell us about how people are presenting. Are they having mild effects, more severe effects? What are your patients experiencing?
So certainly there are cases that are relatively mild, but still can be very traumatic. I always bring up the example of a patient that must quarantine. Even if the rash or lesions are relatively mild, we still are recommending quarantine until the resolution of those lesions. And many people are not able to take 2 to 3 weeks off of work. It impacts not only income, but housing security. And so we're seeing a lot of that impacting patients. But also importantly, a lot of our patients are experiencing very severe symptoms, lesions that can lead to tissue damage, scarring, difficulty with eating and drinking or using the restroom. I mean, this, you know, to give an example, only the most severe patients, the most severe outcomes are recommended for tecovirimat or TPOX, antiretroviral treatment. And so at Callen Lord, we currently have approximately 80 patients that were severe enough and met the guidance to be recommended for TPOX treatment, just to give a sense of the volume of patients that are experiencing severe infections of MPV. And so, you know, also I will mention that TPOX is an experimental medication. It's only been provisionally approved by the FDA for the treatment of MPV. And so every patient that is deemed appropriate, so these are patients in a lot of pain with very severe symptoms, have to go through a really arduous process to access TPOX. And so that's one of the areas of advocacy that we are really promoting, and that is the emergency use authorization of TPOX for the treatment of MPV, so we can expedite this process for patients that are most in need. I will also say across the country, about 10% approximately of patients that have tested positive for MPV are severe enough to be deemed appropriate for TPOX treatment. And about 40% of those patients are living with HIV. And so this is disproportionately impacting our, you know, largely impacting patients that are living with HIV, which is another population of patients that we serve at Callen Lord. And so it's a bit of a concern to us that this medication is so difficult to obtain right now.
Do people with HIV have, now I assume that's some coincidence of just where HIV is colliding with where MPV is showing up, but are there specific reasons people with HIV might be vulnerable to MPV or have particular outcomes with MPV?
Well, certainly any immunosuppression is going to make someone more vulnerable to these types of outbreaks, but there is still much research to be done related to the specific outcomes for patients based on chronic disease history. But certainly I also think, you know, this kind of lends itself to discussions around whether this is something that is like solely impacting the LGBTQ community or the population at large, and where to focus resources and education. And, you know, to your point, you know, these outbreaks always start with social circles, right? And so it is less about sexual orientation or gender identity. You know, viruses do not discriminate to specific populations. Everyone is at risk. And so, you know, when I hear these debates around how to focus outreach and education, I really don't feel that it's an either or, but rather a both and. I think that, you know, we need to target resources toward the population that is being most impacted right now, yet everyone is at risk. And so we need to ensure a public health campaign provides information so that everyone can be as safe as possible.
Anthony, on that note, I've noticed that our community, some of the discussions around how to stop this virus outbreak are really, really split. There are some people, some activists in our community saying shut down the bathhouses, abstain from sex for a number of weeks. There's a lot of echoes, of course, going back to the early AIDS pandemic, and this is very traumatic for people. What can we do? What would you suggest we can do to unify our community and help each other? Because it feels to me that the stigma, I mean, I walked past a pop-up vaccine center in the Bronx the other day. There were 40 people online. All of them were gay men. There was one woman. So it's really, with a visual like that, it's really hard to undo the perception that it's not a gay STD. You know, I even talked to some of the guys up there, and they said they were literally getting the vaccine so that they could continue their lives as they were before. Mm-hmm. What is this doing to our community, and what do you suggest?
Well, we at Callan Lord always approach health education from a very sex-positive lens. We want to provide as much education and information as possible to everyone so that they can make the healthiest decisions for themselves. But I think an important message, an overarching message around this, is to, you know, be very open with your partners about your status. Be, you know, if you know you have any kind of unexplained rash, to reach out to a medical provider, but importantly, to take blame and shame out of this, not only for partners, but especially for yourself. I think it's important for people to not feel ashamed around MPV, you know, infections, and to make sure that they can get quick access to treatment to help stem the tide of further transmission. You know, anytime we talk about sexual health, there tends to be this veil of shame or blame around, you know, any kind of transmission sexually. I think it's important to note that although that is the way in which many MPV cases have been transmitted, that is not the only way in which MPV is transmitted. And in fact, there is no research currently to demonstrate transmission through semen as an example. We are seeing transmission specifically through close skin-to-skin contact. And so, you know, I think that's an important distinction that needs to be made around education that currently exists. And so, you know, if you have lesions, to cover them, you know, washing hands frequently, you know, seeking medical advice if you have any questions or any unexplained rashes on the body, but specifically being really cautious around physical contact, including kissing or you know, any kind of interaction with someone with whom has a rash, or if you have a rash yourself.
Okay, this right, I have like 3 million questions, so let me try to walk through this a little logically. First of all, vaccines. The hysteria has been no access to vaccines. Vaccines locked up in Denmark that the U.S. was not accessing. Where do we stand today on availability of vaccines?
We don't have enough vaccines. We really are hoping that the World Health Organization's recent global health emergency declaration will push our government to also declare a public health emergency and expedite increased access to vaccines, and importantly, a health education campaign targeted toward the communities most impacted right now, but I think also the general population around how to stay safe around MPV transmission.
And do we have any sense that they're on the verge of doing any of those things?
Not at this time, unfortunately. We have far more people that need access to this vaccine than currently are able to access it. And, you know, we are rationing healthcare just as we were at the beginning of the COVID pandemic. And we know when we ration healthcare that only the most privileged people are able to get access to those services. And so health equity is another important component of vaccine access that needs to be centered in the rollout. I think it's really hard to do that when resources are so scarce.
Absolutely.
We're calling on the government to increase access to vaccines so that we can center health equity and make sure that people most at risk for poor health outcomes as a result of an MPV infection get first in line.
One of the most, poignant stories that I keep hearing is the searing pain that people feel from anal lesions. And that it is just at an unbearable level. I wonder whether condoms are a preventive that people should go back to using that they used to use for HIV.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, that is, we like to say, another tool in the toolbox of prevention strategies that can and should be used, dependent on the type of sexual relations you're having, of course. But, you know, it's about providing, you know, a wealth of information that people can lean upon in whatever situation they're in to help protect themselves best. And so, again, it's one of those, you know, both and scenarios where we want to just make sure everyone has all of the information that we have available, and it's provided in a way that is really accessible to people. Not everyone, you know, has broadband and the ability to access the information we have on our website, as an example. I always think back to early days of COVID, where people had no idea why the city was shutting down, though COVID had been in the news for weeks. Not everybody accesses information in the same way. We still have patients coming in with unexplained rashes that are likely MPV that have no idea what monkeypox is and have not heard of it yet. And so, you know, we need to do a better job, I think, of getting the word out to our community to ensure that they can keep themselves safe. But also, you know, we lean on the larger public health infrastructure to support that as well.
And you made reference to the difficulty of accessing TPOX, the experimental treatment for this. We've heard tales of 100-page applications that needed to be filled out to access this because it's not FDA approved for this and available. Is that still the case? Do you see any possibility of that loosening up?
We have been in contact with the CDC. In fact, yesterday there was an announcement of an attempt to streamline that process. It's not quite 100 pages, feels like 100 pages, and it takes approximately 2 hours per patient. So as an example, last Monday at Callen Lord, we had 24, 25 patients in need of TPOX. And so the administrative burden on healthcare providers is also really important as we lean on an exhausted and depleted healthcare workforce to do this administrative work. It requires a medical provider to do a very lengthy assessment and administrative staff to input all of that data into the CDC framework in order for the CDC then to approve the medication and then for the medication to be sent to the patient's home because it is only available through the Departments of Health. And so, you know, I think New York is fortunate in that we have a system in place, but it is a very difficult system to navigate. I know that not all providers have the resources to be able to navigate it, and it's causing delays in care for patients. And it's important to note, again, these are the most severe cases of MPV that are eligible for TPOX. And so we're causing delays in care for the people that really need it the most. Mm-hmm.
Anthony, the White House said a few days ago that they were very optimistic that they could contain this outbreak. As somebody in the front lines, what's your view of that claim?
Well, I am. I would love to see us get in front of this outbreak. I think that there is still time. I think rapid action to get both an increased access to vaccines for those most at risk, as well as access, as more streamlined access to TPOX, because in many ways, treatment, it helps to also expedite the resolution of the infection and decrease the possibility of further transmission. And so an emergency use authorization for TPOX for the purposes of this would also help to stem the tide of exponential transmission that we've seen in the past 2 weeks.
And we have seen at least a couple of cases in children, which, of course, leads the right wing to claim that gay men are raping children and giving them MPV. And you mentioned to us before we started taping people who are incarcerated. Talk to us about these kinds of cases.
Yeah, it's important to note that although the majority of cases of transmission of MPV have happened with skin-to-skin contact, it can also be contracted through touching porous items such as clothing or linens. One of the early cases of a healthcare worker contracting MPV from a patient was through bed linens and changing sheets. And so that is an important additional component to be aware of around transmission. but also it's really important, and I have to mention, that MPV is not very easy to contract. It is not spread through like brief conversations or brushing up against someone or touching things like doorknobs or elevator buttons. You know, these are not ways in which we have seen transmission. And so I don't want to unnecessarily cause concern while we are providing this information. So important thing to note. So, you know, with this, you know, non-sexual, if you will, transmission that's happening, it is important for the general population to be aware that, like, if you have any kinds of symptoms that might be considered MPV, to urgently seek medical attention so that you can prevent spread to roommates, to family members, especially post-COVID. We are in the post-COVID world that we're living in, seeing a lot of multi-generational families living together, which is, you know, an opportunity for transmission to family members. Many people have lots of roommates and unintentionally creating transmission opportunities for roommates. And then, of course, you know, I think back to, you know, the early days of COVID and our correctional facilities not getting early access to vaccination and not wanting to make those same mistakes again.
Diagnosis, we've heard that can be difficult because there's not a lot of lab access to actually test the swabs, and you can't test for the virus with blood work. You have to actually swab lesions, right?
Right, and so I will say that is one area where we are most optimistic. About 2 weeks ago, LabCorp was approved as a commercial lab to begin testing. Early on in the outbreak, we were using public health labs, which quickly became overwhelmed with volume. And so it was pushing out the amount of time until we were getting results. But now that LabCorp is up and running, and earlier this week, the White House announced that Quest would also be beginning labs. So this commercial lab infrastructure is well established and in place and has more capacity to take on the volume of tests. And so fortunately, we are currently seeing a fairly rapid turnaround for test results, which are allowing us to more quickly get people treated.
I have to ask one question out of left field as an old AIDS activist. People used to go to Mexico to get drugs that were not easily available here. Is TPOXX available perhaps outside the U.S. from Mexico or Canada or elsewhere?
Yeah, well, so TPOXX has only been approved, at least in the U.S., for the treatment of smallpox. And, you know, smallpox has been eradicated for some time. And so I would not imagine that it would be readily available simply because of lack of demand in other countries as well. Okay. But that is just conjecture. I've not heard
any. Just had to ask.
I mean, it's a great thought, but I don't know that it's been widely in use for other reasons.
Okay. Maren, anything else before we let Anthony go?
No, I just want to thank you for all your work at Callan Lord. I know we are living in a time of viruses. I think a report came out from, I think it was the WHO, that said that zoonotic viruses were up by 35% or more. So it seems to me there's more of these things coming down the pipeline, and this is just the beginning. What do you, if you could say to the Biden administration, what needs to happen to our health system? It seems we didn't learn much from COVID. What do you feel that needs to change in the system to streamline this if there are going to be more and more viruses like this?
Yeah, I will say that's a great question. We have caused this by underfunding our public health infrastructure. And I similarly feel that we've not learned from the mistakes of the early days of COVID, and the early days of MPV are a reflection of that. You know, we need to invest in a stronger public health infrastructure so that we can be more proactive when these outbreaks occur. And it's always a win and not an if, and less reactive as we find ourselves today. I will also share that I think better communication between departments of health and organizations that are at the front line with other cities around the country is something that we are working to do at Callan Lord. We want to take, you know, lessons learned, being kind of the epicenter of COVID in the beginning and finding ourselves in a similar situation with MPV, we want to make sure that we're sharing our best practices and lessons learned with other municipalities that have yet to see their first case. We want to make sure that Indianapolis is getting the same, information and access to data that we are receiving and that we're sharing best practices so that when cases arrive there, they are better prepared than we were.
Okay. Thank you, Anthony. We'll let you go now because we have a ton more news to cover, but we will ask you to come back, I'm sure, in the near future to update us on all of this.
Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
Okay. And there's word that the Biden administration is going to appoint a national coordinator for this, a czar. We'll see whether that happens. And also the New York City Health Commissioner is asking the World Health Organization to change the name of monkeypox because it's just too stigmatizing and too confusing to people. So maybe they ought to run a contest to come up with a new name.
Wow. Talk about gallows humor. Let's rename that virus. Yeah.
Yeah, there are a few things they could do before then. As Anthony so eloquently described. All right, local politics. Well, we're waiting for the Senate to vote on the Respect for Marriage Act that was passed in the House. That vote may be delayed a little because some senators have COVID, and so that's interfering with getting everybody there to vote. I saw, we record on Wednesday afternoons. I saw an interview with Tammy Baldwin a couple of hours ago on MSNBC, who was being asked because she's supposed to be, as the lesbian senator, the person rounding up Republican votes for this. She claims to be optimistic. She says that there are Republican senators who have signaled to her that they will vote for it, but are not willing to be publicly identified at this point. Heaven forbid.
Yes.
So we're on the edge of our seats waiting for that. But, these Republican senators, they say, we don't need it. This is just a Democratic plot to embarrass us or whatever. But we do need it because there are a lot of laws in place and state constitutional amendments that will kick in as soon as the Supreme Court gets rid of Obergefell and kicks it back to the states, and it will become illegal in states. And Andy raised the question last week, can people actually leave their states and go get married elsewhere where it's legal? And I very cavalierly said, sure, why not? Go to your neighboring state and get married. That's legal. Why not? And I read something this week that said you can be prosecuted for having an evasive marriage if you do that in your home state, if you try to go back there and get your marriage recognized.
It just never ends, does it? I mean, best case scenario, it'll just go back to what it was before, where you can get married wherever you want. You can get married 50 times, but it's not going to be federally recognized. And that's going to, of course, influence immigration and all kinds of things. It's just
federal benefits. So, it's going to be a disaster.
Yeah.
So then we have the case of this representative from Pennsylvania, Glenn Thompson, a right-wing Republican, and he votes no on the Respect for Marriage Act in the House, one of, three-quarters of the Republicans in the House who voted no on it. And then 3 days later, he goes to his gay son's wedding. And they've got audio of him speaking at the wedding about how happy he is to welcome a new son into his family and how great it is that his gay son has found a partner and happiness. That's what you want for your child. And I start, the first reaction is, what a hypocrite.
Right.
But I started thinking about this a little more deeply and thinking, how really desperately afraid these Republicans must be of the minority base that are so angry and violent, and Donald Trump and everybody else, that they would humiliate themselves like this by voting no and then going to their gay son's wedding.
Exactly. And I feel it always disappoints me about politicians who, even though they are elected to serve the public, their private lives are something quite different than what they publicly proclaim. And it's really disappointing because, you know, you can see that Congressman and Mrs. Thompson, they want their son to be happy, but they don't want the laws to, you know, they don't want themselves to be seen to want that happiness for all. So that's more and more becoming the Republican agenda, I think.
Well, they just must feel terror at the idea of risking their public persona, their job, their whatever. The level of terror far outstrips the terror about monkeypox. They are just, and they are, well, I don't know if I should use the word slaves. That may be inappropriate, but they are just trapped in this cage of terror at responding to what the majority public opinion is. They are just, they're in this narrow little box with their masters who are holding them hostage on this stuff.
Right. And that's a theme I always, I think if we go much further to the right, there is going to be the life you live publicly and then the life you have to hide. That's a great segue for this Xander Morich, the gay high school senior who finally delivered his banned graduation speech to the Department of Education because he wasn't allowed. He wasn't even allowed to deliver the content of the speech in his actual school context. So Xander is an out graduated senior from Pineview School in Osprey, Florida, of course, and he was able to deliver his banned valedictorian speech in Washington, D.C. at the invitation of the U.S. Secretary of Education. But it was sad that this is an example of the law now in Florida that was able to ban him from delivering that speech to his Florida high school graduation students because it simply mentioned LGBTQ life and activism. It simply mentioned who he was and what he did. So in a happier note, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona invited Xander to deliver it in front of the U.S. Department of Education. And that was a nice way of overriding the school principal, whose name is Stephen Covet, who basically said, if you mention anything about LGBTQ, we'll simply pull the mic.
Yes, so, and he was the valedictorian, so he got up and gave a speech instead about his curly hair and how he'd always been afraid of coming out about his curly hair. But, you know, that was very clever, but to be able to stand up and with full self-respect and pride deliver the actual speech about being gay at the Department of Education, I think, was just a great triumph.
And it's like Orwellian. It's like doublespeak. I mean, one of the reasons I moved to the United States was because of freedom of speech. You know, it's really one of the only countries in the world that you are allowed to, you know. And now, I mean, this law is terrifying to me.
Oh, please. And then you have Alex Jones claiming free speech to go lie about the whatever. If we get off on this, we'll never do.
Okay.
I just want to point out that Xander is a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the Don't Say Gay law, and there is a new federal lawsuit against the Don't Say Gay law, which is great. And meanwhile, though, in Miami-Dade County, the school board there has banned a two-volume comprehensive health skills instructive book because it mentions gender identity, sexual orientation, abortion, emergency contraception. Parents were allowed to opt their kids out of instruction from these books, but, you know, six parents show up and start screaming about parents' rights, and the county school board pulls the books. So I'm sure that will all be revisited in the lawsuits. Yes, Miguel. Also in the federal government, the Department of Health and Human Services is proposing restoration of the non-discrimination rules in the Affordable Care Act. They had said they were going to do this. They issued the actual rules. This would restore what Trump took out. So with any luck, there will be protection for access to medical care for LGBTQ people that Trump tried to get rid of. All right. In the District of Columbia has a mayor, Muriel Bowser. She's been there for years. Well, who knew? Evidently, it's been an open secret for years that she's a lesbian. But somehow this information passed me by, and I thought I knew more than that. But she was at a ribbon cutting for an LGBTQ homeless shelter, I think, for youth, or community center for youth. And a snarky gay guy said, "So, are you out of the closet now?" And she says, I'm not in the closet. And people say, well, really? And then her office issues a statement later saying she is a fervent straight ally. And, you know, come on, Muriel, get over it.
What does it mean? Is she's an ally to straight people, or she's straight? She's an ally to us.
Don't be coy, Maren. It means straight person is an ally. But you go right ahead and accuse her of that.
Well, I'm interested in this theme of duplicity because she's doing a ribbon cutting for a shelter for homeless LGBTQ people. It's kind of like you need to bring your full self to work. If you are in public service, you need to bring your full self to work. I don't blame people saying, so what's the story? You know, with straight politicians, we all know who their wives are, who their children are, what church they go to.
This goes back to the terror. This is and the punitive nature, and we're about to get into that. First of all, I just want to note that the Victory Fund, which supports LGBTQ candidates around the country and has for years and does a great job, and Anise Parker has been on this show a couple of times recently talking about that, the executive director, former mayor of Houston. They have just announced there are more than 1,000 LGBTQ plus people running for office this year in the United States at all levels, from school board to city council to U.S. Senate and governors. We are everywhere, and clearly this is a response to the attacks by the right wing and people standing up and saying, I'm going to get involved and I'm going to do it. And that is just fantastic. And it's a very diverse slate of candidates. 40% of them are running for the state legislature, which is crucially important, but they are of all ages and races and sexual orientations and gender identities. It's a really inspiring piece of news. Mm-hmm. And even the log cabin Republicans in Texas have admitted that they have failed in trying to convert Texas Republicans to being more humane. And so they are dropping out of the Republican Party there, I think.
Yeah, I hope so. We're going to need the rainbow tide, if we're still allowed to call it that, because the speech Donald Trump gave yesterday is truly terrifying. He's back and he's worse than ever. And it's such a far cry from even that moment where he wrapped himself in the rainbow flag and was like, I'm all really good with the LGBTQ people, because he was basically there slandering our community and saying that we were sickos and grooming children and that there was a transgender takeover. Some of the language he used was so disturbing and also incorrect, because you can fact check a lot of what he was saying, and he's pretty much gotten all of it wrong. But the fact that he's using it at all as a strategy and getting cheers from the crowd, that's the most disturbing part, that he's back this time with a platform. If he does come back for 24, he's coming back on an anti-LGBTQ platform. Before, anti-immigration. Now it's anti-us.
Yeah, you know, no one thinks he's a genius, but he knows how to pay attention to what's going on in the world occasionally. Scapegoating us has a long tradition going back at least the last 20 years on marriage and long before that. Well, you know, go back to the McCarthy era, we have been the scapegoats. But it has turned particularly vicious this year. And this sudden use of language of pedophiles and groomers in sexualizing children has come out of nowhere and is truly terrifying. Now, we have Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, who have attacked a Canadian teacher for decorating his classroom. They have, you know, it's a wonderland, his classroom, and they have gone, he's not even in the United States, and these sickos have gone after him. But the even more vicious stuff is happening around the country. I'm going to go through a little list here. In Boston, neo-Nazis, and I say that because that's what they call themselves. They are the National Socialist Party. That is what the Nazis were called. They showed up to protest a drag queen story hour with signs that said, "Pedo scum off our streets." They got in a fist fight with people trying to defend the place that was holding this very family-oriented event. Three people were arrested. In Arizona, some right-wing nut went into a PetSmart store and started complaining about pride flags that were posted around the store and called all of them there pedophiles and groomers and called the flags satanic and had to be thrown out of the store. In a Chicago suburb, a bakery had to cancel a family-friendly event when a guy broke their windows, left a bag of feces in front of their door, wrote slurs all over the walls, anti-LGBTQ slurs. Luckily, he was caught on camera and was arrested. And one of his slogans after all this was, "Christ is King." Mm. And in New Orleans, a weatherman got homophobic hate mail, an out gay weatherman, got hate mail because someone didn't like his forecast, his weather forecast, and wrote him a note saying, you know, "You're a faggot." And the weatherman talked about it on air and said, "By the way, faggot is spelled with two G's." And back to Canada, a Quebec City nightclub ejected customers because straight customers at the nightclub complained that the customers that were ejected were too gay. And this is what's going on. I list these because this is what's going on everywhere. And this violence and this campaign of terror is only escalating and is just terrifying, I think.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we used to talk about this as microaggressions. There's really nothing micro about it because it's like people are literally going nuts over their differences with other people. It's very devolving into a kind of Game of Thrones scenario in terms of our civic identities. And this is where the role of, I think, certain politicians as unifying figures and as proper lawmakers really needs to come into play. And one of the people who are really stirring the pot and doing bad things is that chap in Texas. Have you heard about this guy who's got a whole bunch of anti-LGBTQ bills going?
Ken Paxton, the attorney general, or
I think Jonathan Mitchell is his name.
Oh yes, the lawyer. Yes, yes.
Former Texas Solicitor General.
He's the one who created the challenge to Roe v. Wade and won that case. He's behind that.
Yeah, and he's behind a bunch of other ones too. I think I don't know if you've covered this before, but he's filed. I think he's got four different cases against our community. One is, of course, about insurance covering PrEP. He doesn't want that.
Yes.
Another one, and he's, of course, he's using religious freedoms to to try and peel that back. He doesn't want private insurers to have to cover certain preventative medical care, specifically PrEP. He's really coming
insane. It's insane. It makes me very worried about the future of the country. All right, here are a couple of tiny pieces of good news. Twitter, TikTok, Meta, Reddit have banned the term groomer from their sites. They have defined it as a slur, and they say you can't use it. And in Pittsburgh, there's a nice little story. We had told this story some time ago of a neighborhood of Pittsburgh where some people had put up a very ugly anti-trans sign in their backyard pointed at their neighbors who have a trans teenager.
Oh, wow.
Hideous. Well, a magistrate court has found that the woman who put up that sign in her backyard is guilty of harassment. And the trans teen was being protected and defended by her gay dads. And neighbors put up protect trans kids lawn signs all over the neighborhood. But now this woman has been officially convicted of harassment. And the Mennonite Church USA will officiate same-sex weddings and apologize for their past denial of that. And Ricky Martin's nephew has withdrawn his lawsuit that claimed Ricky Martin had sexually abused him. The judge dismissed the case. Ricky Martin's line all along and his lawyer was that this nephew was disturbed. We, of course, know none of the truth of the details of the case, but it has been withdrawn, and with any luck, everybody's in better shape. I think we should talk about some more trans women murdered.
Three in the 1 week, I think.
Yeah. Starting with Toy Davis in Milwaukee. 34 years old. Her death has been listed as suspicious. She's a certified nursing assistant. You know, many friends and family who are mourning her death. She was part of a group called Sisters Helping Each Other Battle Adversity. So she was an activist and really appreciated in the community, and now dead at 34.
That's dreadful. I hope they get to the bottom of that. They do flag it as suspicious. That's what Milwaukee. And yes, in Augusta, Georgia, a 26-year-old black trans woman was found dead in a hotel room on July 20th. Kashia Chanel Gator, I think, she's actually of South Carolina, was shot at least one time. She was reportedly traveling with a friend, and her body was discovered by the hotel staff. The police have charged a 22-year-old local man. So at least they do have somebody there.
She was also an active advocate, many family and friends. You know, it used to be that we would see these women targeted because they were alone. But more and more, as trans people live successful lives, they are integrated into communities of family and friends. They do have jobs. They are, you know, members of society. And yet they are still targets of this violence and hatred and bigotry. Mm-hmm. And one more in L.A., Cherry Bush, 48 years old, a trans woman who was homeless, shot dead on the street by a 29-year-old man who was shouting bigoted slurs at her. He's been arrested and charged with a hate crime. Cherry had a rather checkered history and was at one point affiliated with a white supremacist group, but was out of that and living on the streets and became a target.
The Cherry will be the 23rd transgender person reported as a victim of fatal violence this year.
We also lost some members of the community who died who were really striking people. In Philadelphia, Rita Odessa, 76 years old, there you see her in action. She was the executive director of the Philadelphia Lesbian and Gay Task Force for 25 years, known as a tireless fighter. Some people found her difficult. When you're a tireless fighter, you are often labeled difficult. But she got a Sexual Orientation Non-Discrimination Act passed in Philadelphia in 1982, long before New York. Mm-hmm. She established an anti-violence hotline. She fought for funding for gay people, jobs. She fought the Philadelphia Police Department, and she fought for people across all communities. She grew up as a working class woman who brooked no polite compromise, and she fought along lines of race and gender and class, and she was, I described her as a pistol in the headline. She was notorious. And led endless demos and rallies and really fought for everybody. That's a huge loss, Rita Odessa, at 76.
Yes. And living a lot quieter life was Ronnie Solbert, who died at 96 years of age. Ronnie was a very talented illustrator and a modernist artist who lived in New York City. I grew up in Rochester, and in the early 1960s, she was already living with her partner, Jean Merrill, in New York City, where they were, wow, I can just imagine them. They were like a couple of characters from the movie Carol. It's like the golden age of lesbians for me. I would, if I could have Ronnie's life, I would have loved to, because she illustrated all the books written by her partner. Jean Merrill wrote children's books, and they seemed to have a very idyllic existence. They had a farm in Vermont. She taught art up in Vermont at one of the colleges, actually. And the books they collaborated on together always had a really interesting social message. I think their most successful book out of the 18 they wrote was called Pushcart War, which was about, you know, protesting for their local community and organizing when New York's Parks Department announced plans to tear out many of the park's benches and chess tables and community spaces and really old trees to make room for a softball field. They activated all of the community to come and write protest letters and preserve Tompkins Square Park in the city. So they were those lesbians who I love.
Well, of course, I find it highly ironic that lesbians would be protesting against a softball field, but
that's so good.
That's another story. But yeah, they did move to Vermont eventually. They were together 70 years before Jean died. Tony Kushner, the legendary playwright, talks about the pushcart war as his first exposure to the idea of community organizing and protest. And it was a very, very, very popular book, not just a little children's book, but one that really put out the value of community organizing. And then, on a slightly different level, Carlton Varney, who was a legendary interior decorator. He died at 85 in West Palm Beach. And he was also an author, wrote many books. He was an associate of Dorothy Draper, who was an equally legendary decorator. And after her death, he took over her business and was the owner and president for 60 years. He worked on events in the White House. He redid the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia. He worked with Judy Garland. He's survived by his partner, Brinsley Matthews. But again, the end of an era with the death of Carlton Varney. All right. Should we move on to international news? Mm-hmm. Okay. Take it away on Australia. We have very little time left, so let's do this and hopscotch some headlines.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's always disappointing to hear when athletes, it's so hard to come out and sport anyway, and there's such a long history of champion athletes in Australia who were stifled and really made strides when they came out. People like the gold medal Olympic swimmer Ian Thorpe says that a lot of his substance issues and mental illness issues had to do with the fact that he didn't feel he could come out. And Ian Roberts, the rugby player, he did come out and he really did make history there in Australia. So it shocked me when I read this headline that seven players in Australia's National Rugby League boycotted a match that was on today because they didn't want to wear the pride jersey that they were given. It just simply had some quite subtle rainbow stripes. Their managers and coaches didn't warn them. And this team is called Manly Warringah Sea Eagles. This is where I grew up. And I have to tell you, part of me was remembering how homophobic that area of Sydney is and how really blokey and very heteronormative those players on that team always have seemed to me. And there's another cultural aspect to this that might go unacknowledged. The players, the seven that were protesting, are actually mostly Pacific Islanders. And, of course, Pacific Islanders from that region, whether it's Tonga, in the South Pacific or another island nation, they tend to be deeply religious. So I do think there were some issues there. I think management probably should have brought the players in and advised them that this is going to happen rather than springing it on them. But also there is a lot of hypocrisy at work here because that team is also, I believe, sponsored by a brewery and a betting agency.
It says points bet right on their shirts. Yes, and they cited religious objections. All right, we have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to hopscotch some headlines and not cover everything. In Greece, the Orthodox Church is formally objecting to that baptism of the kids of a gay couple. But Greece is no longer going to do corrective surgery on intersex babies. That's good. The Eurovision Song Contest is going to be in Britain because they came in second this year, and Ukraine, which came in first, cannot hold it. Andorra, with a population of 77,000 people, is going to legalize same-sex civil marriage. Many thousands at Budapest Pride in Hungary, in spite of Viktor Orban. There's the picture there. And 150,000 in Berlin at the annual Christopher Street Pride March. And the Bundestag and Chancellery flew rainbow flags for the first time. In Taiwan, the High Administrative Court says the country does have to recognize transnational marriages, one from Taiwan and one from Japan here, even if the Japanese government does not recognize same-sex marriage. Cuba's going to hold a public referendum on same-sex marriage. They've promised that before and withdrawn it. Brittany Griner is claiming she was using cannabis for medical purposes and it was an accident. We're still waiting for the court to decide. And, oh, God, we're not even going to get to the HIV cases. International AIDS Conference, a couple of new cases, stem cell transplants. You can't do them for everyone, but some good news there. And Michaela Cole, who you may remember from I Will Destroy You, is going to play a queer character in Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. We're done. Thank you, Maren. Goodbye, everybody.